my book then, and I could read some sections out of it. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do now.
For what it's worth, and for yours, for those of you who didn't rip it off the board or get one last week, you can have one of these if you wanted, about a couple of my books of the cheaper variety. You got one already?
Yeah. Thank you.
I don't have many with me, so if you got one, don't take one. If you don't really want one, don't take one. Making nail soup is hard, particularly since church presses are so well set up business-wise.
Stone soup,
okay.
I've never heard of nail soup. Stone soup.
I'm going to make peanut shell and cherry pit soup after tonight, I think. Oh, no.
There they go.
No matches.
Blend of two themes that arose when we discussed the first time I came in here this summer as forum possibilities. One was on something that you didn't need Time Magazine about three or four issues back. I've been out of touch with civilization so long, I don't know how many issues have come out since, about the occult revolution. You may have seen that. It was the second Time Magazine devoted its cover and its cover story to that particular theme in a short period of time. So this is just one sort of little indicator of the importance of the topic, I suppose. The other topic being something equally much a part of the social scene right now, the so-called Jesus Revolution, or what I would rather call neo-Pentecostalism or a revival of interest in the Spirit, again, had a Time cover. That doesn't mean much, but it's a statistical indicator that even the secular press has to pay some attention to something that's going on with the attendant kinds of phenomena, which some of you know from first-hand experience, perhaps all of you have read or heard about, called technically glossolalia sometimes, or speaking in tongues, healing, gifts of prophecy, and other sorts of things. We did that last Friday night as an independent theme, and it was a rather interesting session to me, not just because I was a leader, far from it, but from the feedback I got from the people. How many are here tonight that were here last Friday night when we did the glossolalia? There are a few. I wonder if any of our testimonial people are here. I don't see them yet. I think they're probably... Yes, one is, aren't you? Yeah. Maybe you'd like to come sit on top of the fire. We've got one. The other lady's not here, is she? She's already gone? Okay. So, in effect, what I'm doing is apologizing to you for running two themes together. But tomorrow night, we're going to use this particular slot for... a movie, which is only good fun in one way, in another way shows, I think, the length of time in this country that we've been concerned with the themes of occultism and spiritualism and so forth. It's the old film Bell, Book, and Candle, which you've probably seen on TV at night numerous times, but it's still good fun, you know, kind of interesting little thing. And then Friday night, there'll be a forum in which we can discuss movies and maybe themes that we lift up tonight if you want to, or something else, maybe that grows out of the other hour, 6:30 to 8 o'clock, for those of you who came to that tonight. Whatever in general you want to do. In fact, I just went down and borrowed from my good friend Wes in the pool hall two old films, which might be rather good and would be more illustrative of what we were talking about at the pre-Vesper hour for those of you here then. How many were here tonight, 6:30 to 8? See how much carryover. Okay, there's no use saying more than you have to. One of them's called Thrills of War. I understand it's rather good, and the other one's an old Western Bang Bang picture, so maybe we'll show that Friday night if we can rip off a projector someplace or do something. Okay. If you look at this theme, and I guess you'd almost have to from the standpoint of cultural anthropology, It's only in recent times that ages of rationalism have come into being, when the animistic beliefs that gave unity to all of life were cast down in certain selective parts of the world. In tribal societies, in what we, I think, in a very superioristic and false way call primitive societies, a talk upon Holy Spirit and unholy spirits would not be of a peculiar nature. And yet, I dare say I would not be alone in thinking that it is a kind of peculiar topic even for church groups and in a church camp. But with the exception of perhaps a minute part of the philosophical population among the ancient Greeks, a very few people in Europe in the Renaissance, very few, because it was a highly spiritualistic and occult period of time. We spent a good deal of time last Friday night talking about that one theme. And I would say since the 1800s in Western Europe and in parts of North America, with these small exceptions, the human race as a whole has simply accepted the fact of the existence not just of Holy Spirit and of unholy spirit, of God and devil, but of multitude of spirits, all of which in some way and according to various philosophies and theologies melded themselves under the aegis of one great spirit, Manitou, if you will, the great spirit of the Plain Indians, or as in the case of Religionsgeschichte, the so-called study of the history of religions, we find what is called the sky god. One god who, although he is relatively unknown and remote from the life of the people, such that he never enters into their worship, nevertheless is believed in and gives a firm foundation for everything else. The Australian Aborigines, who've now come so far to civilization, as people from Australia who've been in here have told us, melded into the university system, part of a university system in this country of students and so forth. Nevertheless, until quite recently, as far as time is concerned, lived in a culture that had not moved beyond the stage where men had to move around on the cover of darkness to escape the heat of the sun, to find damp spots in the earth or places in the earth where they might dig a little hole and find a little water under the sand, and where they might dig up taro or yam roots and live upon those things, eating them raw. There was an economic culture no farther advanced than that, in which they had only one or two things that we might be able to call tools. A boomerang, of course, is well known to all. A throw stick, a kind of a way to propel another stick with a pretty good velocity so that you might knock over a small kangaroo would be the other. This would be about it. And yet, over against the backdrop of what we would say was almost no science and no technology, we find when the religion historians study and talk to these people and learn their languages, a terribly complex and sophisticated language which is directed towards the spirit world, the world of Never Never Land, the world in which they live and they move and they have their being, and a very kind of sense that Paul speaks of the essence of religiosity, I suppose, in his Areopagus speech. A world in which there are words and concepts for the divine and for the demons, for dreams and for spirits, for portents and for fortunes, which even the most advanced societies before the advent of this rationality in Europe really never reached. We find that the invisible world, the invisible culture of the Aborigine, and this also holds true for the natives of Papua and of New Guinea and so forth, and of the islands of the Pacific and in other parts, so-called primitive parts of the world, their invisible culture is so far sophisticated, so far advanced over our religious culture, at least in its complexity and in the philosophy that lies behind it, that it's not funny. This is the kind of thing that the sociologist, anthropologist Claude Levi-Strauss has tried to bring across
and the Savage Mind. I don't know how many of you have read this or know about Strauss's work, which he points out that the so-called savage mind is a more highly tuned philosophical and theological instrument. He doesn't care that much about theology, but it's philosophy and psychology that concerns him at this point, and sociology is a more highly attuned and sophisticated civilized instrument than is our mind. And he illustrates this by a number of examples, a lot of which I had learned myself years ago in anthropology and didn't really make much sense to me. For example, there being 50 words for a sweet potato in one of the tribal languages of New Guinea, and with subtle nuances as to whether the sweet potato was dry or damp or young or old or fresh or green or yellow, and all these things could be complementary characteristics expressed in a single word. So it gives us a wholly different idea about man, and we see then what I must do now to try to get these things together and lay a basis. The truth as presented, I suppose, finally just given a sort of a poem by Paul Tillich, the theologian, man is a religious being. This is all there is to it. And so man in his natural state is a religious being. And in the state of the world as it was, I suppose, in some places, very few places on this earth, between some parts of the 1700s and until some 25 years ago, because we have passed the age of rationality now, where man did not think of himself as a religious being, was an aberration. And consequently then, the twin themes that we want to lift up and talk about tonight, the eruption, and actually it was in this order, first of the devil and then of the Holy Spirit, if you want to speak in flat-out theological jargon, but first of a revival of religious practices that we would know as arcane or occult, of the vicar, or as they say in debased English, of the witches and the astrological and the horoscopial kinds of attitudes. This eruption and then the more recent eruption of Pentecostalism, of holiness, and rather fundamentalistic theological jargon with the belief that one is possessed by the Spirit, one can speak in tongues, one can heal, one can do this, that, and the other kind of thing. I understand from our talk the other night, actually speaking a tongue which is understandable, like Turkish or something of this nature, when one has not studied it, these kind of phenomena have followed on, rather than being aberrations away from the norm and signs of psychic ill health. I think we take the long-range view of the cultural anthropologist, of the historian of religion, of the psychologist and sociologist of religion, and indeed of the secular variations of those disciplines, is not an radical move away from health and wholeness, but actually is simply a swing of the pendulum away from a very short moment in the life of man where he missed, as it were, the real nature of his being. So you will find, as you already know, some of you know me before this week, and some of you have known me just from the last lecture, I'm a very critical person, and you may think I'm negative and completely cynical, but it's, I want to preface this by saying this. Now we can be critical. Now we can look with analytic eye. Now we can pick up and feel and handle and dissect as we must if we would understand, because the purpose of learning is not to worship, it is to understand. Within that context, and I'm not speaking about the eruption of these attitudes and these experiences as necessarily prima facie evidence of mental distress or aberration, although there are most certainly many instances in which that is a part of the whole process. Man is a religious being, and we have entered, much to the dismay of many academics and political types and cynical types, manipulative, competitive, economic types, who have dominated the West and other parts of the world for a long time, I would say back into the state in which man is most human. That is, in the state in which it is not surprising to him that life is more than meat and drink.
in the body more than clothes and cars and houses. So, 5 years ago, you must forgive me, but I've done so many different kinds of research and written so many books I can't remember. 5 years ago, I suppose, 6 years ago, if anyone said, spend a year or so and study occultism, I would have thought they were nuts. Product of 13 years in university and 5 degrees, in which I found more truth about the human condition in sociology and psychology and anthropology than I did in religion, and could really make religion sensible only because of the insights that came from those disciplines, I would have laughed and said, you're nuts. But about that length of time ago, I was in the city of Philadelphia, where there are 3 publishers with whom I've worked for years, and an agent, and we're having dinner, and someone says, what do you think about the occult explosion? And this was long before it was any common knowledge. I said, you mean these people who are fooling around and think they're witches? I said, they've been smoking too much hash. Grass is too easy to get. Oh, don't you think there's more to it than that? Well, I don't know. Why don't you, before you close your mind to it, a young man said to me, look into it. Okay, I'll look into it. But why should I really? Because if you will come with me, I told this story last week, and I hope it's still the same on the 2 tapes when they compare them, because it is an actual case. It says, if you'll come with me, we'll walk through some of the bookstores in Philadelphia, and we'll see what the people are reading. Because secular bookstores don't just stock books because they're by seminary professors, you know, the way our bookstores do, or because they're supposed to be good for your spirit. They're in the business to make money. So let's go. So we left the restaurant and we began a tour of that city, going to the various bookstores, seeing what was on display and what people were buying. We actually went to the managers and talked to them and asked them and consulted some of their records in the cases where they would cooperate with us. And we found that there were no books that you or I would call religion or religious in the narrow sense that we think of religion as being about the Bible or theology or one of the ancillary disciplines like philosophy or psychology, sociology of religion, prominently displayed. There were some there, but they were shelved back where you almost had to ask to get them or search for them. And they weren't really that many even then. There were Bibles, but even they were shelved back and not necessarily prominently displayed except in the bookstores that lost money, that is the religious ones. And that's exactly what they do. And yet, the themes of the books were not what the moralists would lead you to believe, the ones that were really moving the most, pornography and violence necessarily, but they were occultic in the broadest sense, most of them about astrology. You know, cooking with your birth sign, giving birth to your baby under your sun sign, and, you know, everything, picking your nose under the right sign, and all, just, you name it, and it's there, and it's in paperback, and it's in plastic, and with metal rings, and in $5 editions, $15 editions, pictures, anything you want. And of course, this, as I say, was about 6 years ago, and that thing is, you can multiply by 50 at a conservative estimate now. Well, this so provoked us that we said, yes, we're going to have to get into this. We've got to understand what is happening, because we not only have a new social phenomena, which is religious in the widest sense and certainly in the true sense of the word, but it also is a direct threat to what we know as religion, and it hits us too, where we live, because we're in the business of writing and selling books about religion. That's what interests us. So out of this, I drew up, after doing some more preliminary investigation, a proposal which eventually became the book known as Religion in the Age of Aquarius, which came out, has outsold all my other books, and the only one of them that made a book club, because it became a book club selection. And that must say something, because I didn't think it was as good a book as some of my others. But at the same time, I think it perhaps broke first, but I would say within the next month, 2 or 3 other religious publishers also brought out books that are religious studies of the occult, and it has been continuing since then. But I said there was a parallel to this. The publisher of one of the larger denominational publishing houses, again, one quartered in Philadelphia, was given a 6 months leave of absence due to this particular experience we had that few days there in Philadelphia together. His salary and expenses being paid by the trade association of the Lutherans, Presbyterians, Methodists, you know, so forth, publication houses, took 6 months off to study in depth what was happening. What are the reading tastes of the American public? What is the future of publishing per se? What is the future of religious publishing per se? What do people want? What do they obviously believe in or have a strong interest in, because they put that cold hard cash down on the counter to get? And the 6 month study substantiated what we had found on a little topical individual basis walking around one city over a couple of days. And they found that people are buying more books than ever. There are more titles being published than ever. There are more, if you use religion in the broad sense, religious titles being released than ever, and more of them being bought by title and numbers of individual copies of that title, but that about 9 out of 10 of such books are occultic rather than religious, if looked at from a Jewish or Christian point of view. And this, by the way, is not able to cover the vast market of paperback magazines and periodicals having to do with astrology and horoscopes and so forth, which pass over the drugstore and in the train stations and so forth. And you know about those kinds of things that have been around for years. The kind that used to be down on the bottom shelf next to the crossword puzzles. You know, you might find Fate and Strange and a couple of titles like that, only now you find 50, 60 titles on any large periodical display. We couldn't even begin to cover those. We limited ourselves to trade editions, that is, hardback and paperback books. Now, somebody is reading a lot of books on the occult. I mean, you know, that's the first thing that we could find out, and none of us were really surprised. And the second thing was that not only did we have an economic battle to fight, but if we were really in this for more than just the joy of writing books and making money, and there's little joy in both of those things, and we don't do either one very well, then if we really were interested in religion from the Christian point of view and the Jewish point of view too, because they're in this with us, I suppose everybody else in the religious traditions are, then we better understand it. And so that's what I set out to do. And I don't know that I thoroughly understood it, but there are so many of us now working on it that perhaps we're getting a clear picture. Just in brief, and now since the one copy of the book I had walked away this last week, I can't give you, as I did, the foreword and the epilogue. I felt constrained to write an epilogue, by the way, to this book, the first and only time. And I can't read you a few detailed passages about practices which I was able to go in and to observe, since I have been a student and a member of the so-called counterculture, or whatever you want to call it, from its inception. In fact, it's almost the second time around for me in the counterculture. I was able to go and see some things that are close to the ordinary person, and I describe them in disguised terms in this book. But I simply have to try to give you a digest now of what I found. I found that there is this retribalization, which was first mentioned by McLuhan now 10 or 12 years ago. Earlier, if you were a journal article reader by McLuhan and others, and I don't think his name ever appears in the book because his thought has just become common property today. There had been this retribalization due to the community building that we discussed in the last hour together, on the one hand by the mass media bringing us all together, but that it was a kind of pseudo-community, or a community at one level or dimension only, that left us feeling more alone when we were together than when we were not so close together. And that in this loneliness, in this sense of alienation, with this sense of frustration, with this sense in some way that the natural processes of our life were thwarted by each other and by the structures of society around us, there was a search for satisfaction and meaning inchoate, that is non-verbalized in most, but highly verbalized and articulate in some, going on all over this country and countries of similar development, and that this particular search or quest for meaning had begun to take on, first in university communities, or communities like that with a large population of intellectuals and free spirits, and later spreading right down to the boondocks, and I mean right down to the crossroads communities with a high school and a gas station, that was of an occultic nature. That this spread not against any resistance from the church, but that the church, as usual, didn't know what time it was and what was going on, and that in many cases it had contributed to it. That the practices of religious worship by many religious bodies were themselves perhaps more occultic than faithful, and that they had easily been a bridge or stepping stone for some. I found, however, that the occultic underground, or now we could call it an underground church, since it has formally organized itself in many instances, was made up in its hardcore, however, of people who had completely rejected the Jewish and Christian tradition, so that they were more akin to the agnostics and the so-called atheists that we wished were still around because we knew how to deal with them, than they were of the larger fringe group of the occult, which were kind of baffled Baptists, loony Lutherans, and pooped out Presbyterians and this sort of thing. But the hardcore, and I read last week when I had my book the sociological description of them after some time, but they were made up something like this. People who lived in a community generally larger than the one in which they were born. People who had entered upon the educational treadmill through high school or college, but generally who had not completed it, and usually because they had no desire to do so. People who were generally single and mostly under 30, but not limited to that, and that the outstanding leader types that I was able to isolate and talk to generally tended to be 10 to 15 years older than their followers. People who generally tended to congregate and live together on the modality of the so-called hippie pad or rooming together, usually on a ratio, and I was able to see enough of these things, by the way, in enough states to get it, of 3 women to 2 men, which is a nice ratio, I suppose. And generally speaking, who were also into the drug subculture, which is a heck of a lot bigger than the religious or occult subculture, at least in this country, and for whom these kinds of interest in astrology and prediction and forecasting and character analysis of themselves and their friends and their acquaintances sometimes had passed over into some organizational form of meeting together for worship, if you want to call it that. For others, it never went that far, and I have been encouraged, and I'm thinking seriously now of doing another book on that, that occultic practices such as casting of horoscopes, which I had done, several of them, by the way, even paid for one of the big expensive computerized ones, Paul, which are kind of something, generally utilized occultic practices for what I would call purposes of self-analysis and psychotherapy. In other words, they were getting or trying to get on the kind of integrity and inner self-understanding that we would hope Christian faith made available to all church members, but seemingly often does not. So that there were various kinds. Other, just as this top of the head broad categorization so you can ask me questions. Another very large typology that I would introduce was the difference between black and white. That is between those who were convinced that they had now been recovering arcane or occult, that is hidden knowledge, which would enable them to do good for themselves and their friends. That it would make them white witches. By the way, the term warlock is not used for males. Witches are witches, whether they are men or women. But that white magic or a white occultic practice would be for some good purpose. And others who had decided that this universe, like a lot of Christians I know, is really sort of equally divided between two superpowers, and the spiritual cold war between God and devil is raging on. And from all the latest reports from the ships at sea, the devil is winning, and so they thought they would worship the devil. This would be the black side of it. And therefore, by means of practices, charms, amulets, spells, other sorts of things, one would placate and make friends with the black spirits, with the dark or evil spirits, and find good for himself and disharmony for his enemies in that way. Usually when we become concerned about the occult, by the way, it is because of the so-called black witches or the black practices. And here is where you can more clearly see classical examples of mental illness, I might say. You also see the people most spaced out on pretty heavy traffic, like the heroin and things of this nature in that particular group. But it's all occultism, whichever way you cut it. These are some of the things I found. Yeah. Sure. I can't do that completely, but it's the same way in which I did the New Mentality and in which my brother and I got into the Minutemen and the Ku Klux Klan and other things and did the Turn Right, which is our book on political fundamentalism or American fascism, just by being very duplicitous, I suppose, or very malleable and fitting in very easily. Being white, Protestant, Anglo-Saxon, and an ex-Marine gets you in a lot of places. You know, if you're not afraid and you're not particularly dignified, as I'm, you know, pretty obviously not, and then also living in the university community where this was going on, you have friends and friends have friends and so forth. And I have a lot of friends who also are in the psychiatric world that introduced me to people. In fact, the book I'm going to do on occultism and psychotherapy is based on case histories of people treated by psychiatrists that I know. So by various and sundry ways of just walking up and down the world, traveling all the time, and in these peculiar intellectual circles, you meet people. Then also, people will accept you one time to test you, to see if you're a narc, if you're going to turn them in, you know, or if you're a spy, or if you're a big mouth or something. And when they find it, while you'll record what you've said, but you'll carefully disguise their names and places so that nobody gets in trouble, that word gets around too. It's just like news reporting.
They know what you're about and this is okay?
I never lie when I ask people or pretend to be something I am not. You'd only need to be caught out in a lie one time. And you could die. I mean, it would be more than losing your profession. You really could. So, my brother, for example, got us to interview the Grand Dragon in North Carolina because the Grand Dragon's chief bodyguard had been a sharpshooter instructor in the Marine Corps with my brother. But, you know, it's just that sort of thing. It's like newspaper reporting. And then if you're crazy yourself, it helps. But these things happen all around us, and most of us just don't have the perceptual ability to know what's going on. The talismans are all there. Let me tell a story on myself since you asked the question, and it illustrates this. I did the research for the New Mentality years ago and did it on a grant from the Lutheran Church and brought the book out with the conception that there was a new mentality long before it became popular for people to think in these terms. But while I was doing that, The talismans and the signs of the coming occultic revolution were there. And this was the thing that struck me during this visit to Philadelphia, when this young man, who was at the time an editor of another denomination's church press, brought this to my attention. It just struck me at the time, my God, there's 25% of the material that I gathered, I didn't use. The signs were there. It hadn't yet come, but the direction was clear. And my mind sifted out and screamed out and just paid no attention to magic. Paid no attention at all. For example, when I was investigating what people call hippies and so forth, and all the interest in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, you know, and an Egyptian Book of the Dead, and these kinds of things, I said, religion. You know, and Marcia Iliadi, my teacher, was sitting on my shoulder, you know, religion. I said, it didn't come to my mind that these are occult magical texts. It didn't come to my mind, you know, that the little mottos and sayings and designs sewed on the pants and hung on the wall and so forth. I thought, oh, art, bohemianism, you know, or some stupid thing like that, magic. It didn't come to my mind that the paranoias that were so very evident, and particularly in high drug risk areas, might not just be chemically induced, because they're not all chemically induced by any means. It just was screened out by the fact that I was a rationalist, not through and through. I wouldn't have been interested in the first place, but so highly rationalistic I couldn't understand everything that was going on. So I really didn't deserve the praise that the book got on that score. I missed that completely. I put down a lot of the totems and a lot of the magical objects that I saw as I went around to American Indian influence. A lot of other people do too. And while there's certainly that kind of an imagery, that's not the major thrust of so much of the totems and the magical objects. Or if it is American Indian, it's only because that is the most close source of animism, you know, to our culture, I suppose, this sort of thing. So again, your mind has to be attuned, and it's not always. I wondered when I finished doing Religion, Age of Aquarius, what did my mind screen out that I didn't see? And I'm very serious. What did we miss? I'm sure that we missed something. And it would be the secret as to what the next wave will be. But I also had the feeling when I finished that this is not something that's going to be over soon. That this Age of Aquarius business is not just publicity, it's not just cultural fadism or phenomenalism, but that this is something that will be with us a long, long time, because the religious needs of man are being faced up to consciously as well as unconsciously again for the first time in centuries, and that the church is simply not ready or willing to be the church in that big sense again, because none of us who make up the church perhaps are willing to make it a full-time profession again. It's more than that, but it's at least partly that. So being open to what's going on around. One of the things that I concluded, and I will stop with this, is that witchcraft is real, and that magic is real. And I concluded this not with the hesitation I would have a few years before, but with a good deal of alacrity, particularly since I had medical support. I went through the literature, and we went through some cases, some medical friends of ours did of so-called voodoo death, death by hoodoo, if you will. Cases, I might say, I've seen in this country and university communities damn near come off, people almost frightened to death by other people. And we went to, well, I can only tell you about the hippie type communities or the passive people, which is, by the way, my definition of a hippie is a passive type personality, a passive adaptation to the world, very beautiful adaptation, I personally think, who live in constant fear of the little hard group of devil worshippers, who are really aggressive and mean, you know, although they look very much on the outside like the rest, but are really mean and like manipulating people and scaring people to death. I can tell you about the boy at the University of Kentucky. The medical friend of mine and I paid a visit to one night, couldn't get in his room. Every door was locked, and we could see him sitting in there in a sort of catatonic state, and we were worried about it. Finally, we went in through a window. And he wasn't really unconscious or out of his mind. He was just sitting there petrified with fear and not moving. And when we talked to him, he told us that he'd been hoodooed, or he'd had a spell laid on him by somebody that we had heard about that had a very bad reputation about two blocks from there. And, well, he's over there, and you're here, and we're here now, and we'll neutralize this, because we soon learned to enter into people's, if you want to call them delusions, you may, which is now an accepted psychological technique, I might say. We soon entered into their dream world, if you want to call it that, or into their reality with them. We're here, and we can bless you. We can neutralize this. No, it's not as simple as that. He says, he's here in the room. And we said, well, is he invisible? No, he's quite visible. He's right over there, and he points over towards the door leading into the bathroom. And we walk over and look in there, and there is, sitting in the middle of the bathroom, one of these old-fashioned pole lamps, you know, like bends over and the lamp hangs down. And I said, there's nothing but a lamp in the bathroom. And he said, that's him. That's him. I knew he was going to put a curse on me, he said. He sent me word. And he said, this morning when I was coming back in after being out all night, he said, I found this lamp on the trash pile. And I thought, I'm going to rip this off. This will really be good in the apartment. He says, and like a fool, the spell was already on me. I brought the lamp in. And he says, and then it struck me about 11 o'clock this morning. I've been sitting here in a corner, he said, in fear ever since, that he is that lamp. That lamp is him. And he's waiting to get me when I let down my guard. And the looks of terror on a lot of people now, these people have tried, you know, various kinds of things that would be illegal, I suppose, and the amount would be known only to God. But I wouldn't think that the majority of people that we talked to had been as spaced out as some other people that we've seen and not suffered such delusions, because they were not, or if you want to call them delusions, they were not subject to this kind of psychological pressure. Witchcraft works by suggestion. And we are a very suggestible people. Adolescence and young adulthood is a highly suggestible age. That's how courtship is possible, by the way. Think about it. And that the power of suggestion is a very real one indeed. You know, this whole distinction, oh, it's all in your mind, so it's not real, that's real great until you kill yourself or somebody else. It's real if it's in your mind, okay? You see that ontology is bigger than stones and sticks. This power of suggestion can be really used on an intuitive basis by some people. Very intuitive. Others do it more calculatingly. And the ones who become witches, I suppose, develop an intuitive sort of manipulation of others by suggestion on the basis of what, for want of a better word, would be, I would say, an immoral use of psychological principles. Suggestibility. Same thing in healing. Excuse me.
Is there any connection at all in people who are easily hypnotized, for instance, to lead to that psychic phenomena as opposed to people who would be susceptible to suggestions by...
I would say, as an opinion only, that there might be some parallel. The only way you could get an answer to that would be to take some people who had shown susceptibility in this way and then test them for hypnotic tendency. Most of the experiments with hypnotism that I've seen, I thought were quite unconvincing, may I say. I've never seen one yet that convinced me that it was genuine or that the suggestion had taken. But that's, again, just an opinion and just based on things that I've seen over a number of years, too. But certainly, hypnotism, as I understand it, is supposed to function as works upon the lines of suggestibility. Yes, an association. But now, as far as any studies, none have been made that I know of. There may be some that would be worth making. But these people aren't hypnotized because, you know, that hypnotism is supposedly more exact and on a one-to-one basis. This is more like a suggestion, an aura, this kind of business.
Well,
In your investigations, did you run into these people that leave their bodies and go on trips?
Yes. Astral projection.
Yes.
That seems to be one of the areas of the occult that's growing like mad. More and more people. I thought, always thought, that was the furthest out. Boy, that's really far out. But that's the one that's growing. I guess I should have put my money on that.
Wow. Everybody can do that, apparently.
Well, apparently not everybody can, but everybody's supposed to have, according to the theory, the ability to do it. That's far out. But of course, you know, clinically speaking, that would be a complete schizophrenia, I suppose.
Yeah.
Think about it. But you get lots and lots of reports.
Lots of perfectly square kids are telling you how they flew up with the sparrows and ran into some electrical light bulbs and had to come down.
Yeah. And people looking down on their own bodies,
right,
and so
right,
forth.
Right.
Yeah, you get a lot of this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, usually in classes of kids, you know, you'll ask them after you get on a good basis with them. Like, be perfectly fair and frank now. Don't say you've done something you haven't done. But how many of you done this, that, and the other thing? One nice thing about young people today is they will tell you, you know, don't hide. And the occurrence of so-called astral projection or soul travel is it's quite remarkable. Maybe 10% or something like this. I'm not sure in the groups that I've seen. Experiences of deja vu, of having been through an experience before is much higher. I'd say 20% or something like that. You know what deja vu is? How many in here, honestly, have ever had an experience like that? Having lived through an experience before.
And you know what's going to happen.
You know
yeah.
what's going to happen before.
Yeah.
That's something. You see, these are the kind of things on which people build because they may not be completely... explainable. In fact, I don't know any behavioristic psychology that can explain that outside of talking about a mental aberration. But the statistical incidence of experiences of deja vu is really high, very, very high.
This would be tied in with the growing belief, I think a growing belief in reincarnation.
Reincarnation, yeah, it's really God-losing, apparently, and it is, of course, one of the so-called physical evidences, or let us say, better term would be experiential evidences for prior life, yeah.
Don't you think, though, that it could have been a dream or something that you had a long time ago, and it's just something that reminded you of that dream, and it was stuck with that here and there?
This is a Freudian or, a more... traditional interpretation. No, I'm not laughing at it. This is the interpretation often given. The trouble is it doesn't meet the facts when you have the experience yourself. And when you compare people's experiences and do it, you know, in isolation, it's kind of interesting. I had this experience as a young man, about 17 years old, and in Japan. I had never been in Japan before, and I stepped off the ship. And I walked through the docks, and through the gates of the Navy Yard, and I'd immediately been there before, in the area outside that, and it was that way for the rest of the day, at least it seemed to be, which I found, you know, really kind of thrilling in a weird way and exciting. I probably was insane too at the time because we were getting ready for the Incheon invasion, although I didn't know that, thank goodness. But it was kind of unique. It was interesting. I'm not sure I'd ever read a book about Japan before, but, you know, people report these kinds of experiences. It's, nobody thinks you're nuts if you have had a deja vu experience, because there wouldn't be enough guards to keep the rest of us inside.
In your experiences with people and these occult things, do you ever run into people who aren't what you have?
How do you mean that now?
As far as the Christian life, I'm sure they don't... From what you say, maybe they do, maybe they don't know you're a Christian, but just by your own demonstration in your own life, do they ever recognize their trouble and they have asked you how you got what you have?
Actually, not. That's probably my fault. But I would have to say this further. These are just gross generalizations, you know, one man's opinion. No science here, okay? Although I think that scientific evidence would tend to bear this out to a degree. Most of the people in the occultic world, to the degree that I would say it's not just a passing fancy or the interest that all of us have. I mean, none of us turn away from reading Time magazine because it's got the occult on the cover. And probably we pick it up a little bit faster than we do when it's got some picture of the Vietnam War on it. Let's be perfectly fair. The occult is fascinating. And it probably would be to a Benedictine monk if they allowed him to read Time magazine. It's just a fascinating thing. And this is one of the things we have to go along with it. It smacks of romance. And it gives a little thrill of fear. And, you know, it smacks of adventure, if you will, and of the unknown and the hidden. And therefore, it's got a kind of a built-in thing going for it, very much like the flower and the bee have these things going for them, I suppose. But now the second thing I would say, those who are not just in on the romantic fantasy and the romantic trip, and that would be a lot of people, that would take many millions, I think, of the many millions of people who are part of this occultic revolution right there. When you get beyond that, I would say the most typical personality configuration and kinds of questions and answers that you would find in such people is confusion. And so asking a clear question like that probably isn't possible. But now I don't know. That's just an opinion. Yes, sir.
My understanding and personal philosophy definition of religion is basically the attempt or a system for trying to understand and control oneself and one's circumstances.
And understand and control what?
Understand oneself and one's
circumstances. And one's circumstances.
I would take that as a definition of philosophy rather than of religion.
Well, it's also my assumption that most philosophy is very directly religious. But assuming this, it's my understanding that the vast majority of those who get into demonic, the astrological, or the holiness, or for any other thing that relates to this, is simply striking out for the attempt to be able to be something other than a robot.
You're exactly right. To find meaning, to search, to quest for an intensity of feeling, a depth of meaning, and not just an intellectual one, although many people want that. Oh, absolutely right. Yeah, this is why I call it religious, but in this sense it is a quest, you know, for unity with being or with meaning, which is quite different. In fact, I would say at this point, while I am a Lutheran and influenced heavily by Karl Barth at this point, even against the fact that Paul Tillich was my personal teacher, I think there's a distinction between faith and religion. Religion always is, as Carol has said here, man's last sinful attempt, you know, and he's really his most glorious sinful attempt, you know, to thwart God and be his own God. I think that's true. But religio means the tie that binds, and it binds things up. Life makes sense. It has a center. As the old Indian says, you know, in the movie, a white man's crazy. He doesn't know where the center of the universe is. Religion gives us a center, and this is good. It's part of health. Faith, we think, in Revelation goes beyond that. But now, where religion is different from occultism is precisely in the attempt to manipulate and control your environment. Religion at its best says, not my will, but thine be done. Occultism says, not thy will, but mine be done. This is the difference in occultism. All occultic spells, all occultic practices are designed to bring the hidden or invisible forces, as they believe them to be, or the psychological forces, because some of them are very super sophisticated people, into line with their desires. In other words, I want to work a charm to make that man, you know, raise my salary, or that woman love me, or this person let me use his car. And this, I would say, is the real difference between religion and occultism.
What about the healing part that you mentioned?
We'll get to that. Let's ask this question.
I definitely believe that you're right there. That is the, you know, key. Yeah. I personally wonder whether is it fair to generalize saying that the occult then is not in a true definition sense religion.
No, it is religion in the broadest human sense. But I mean, this is the distinction between it. It is egocentric.
Yeah.
in the extreme. Highly egocentric. In fact, that's how it works, by the suggestibility of strong egos upon weaker egos.
It's my understanding that this is the also the thing of 99% plus of what's called Christian.
To that degree, then you are only saying what I said last week, and it's not just as an offhanded cut that most Christian worship and most Christian practice is just occultism.
Mm-hmm. Is what?
Just occultism.
Right.
Particularly when you're into religion or the church for the good that it can do you, or the community or the nation. That's occultism in an elevated sense. Egocentricity, after all, is Calvin's definition of sin. If you want to get on that level. Now, she asked about healing. Well, by the same token, there are healings that take place in these occultic practices. And this is makes up a great deal, particularly the white magic thing. It works by suggestion. But it's always not thy will, or not the will of whatever forces there are and so forth. And you find, you know, just as much denominationalism and sectarianism among the occultists, perhaps more than you do among the above ground churches. Some speak about impersonal powers, some speak about multitudinous gods, others about the old gods before Christianity displaced them in Europe, others talk about, you know, Olympian spirits or the Tibetan gods and so forth. Others talk about God in Judeo-Christian terms. I would say the majority probably do, God and the devil, and this popular fundamentalism based on paradise lost rather than the Bible. But whether they do or not, the idea is not what the great spirit or spirits want, but what we want. And of course, you can easily see where a great deal of Christianity is simply occultism, baptized in that sense. I'd say that's the big thing. The idea is Schleiermacher, the first great systematic theologian of religion, and by the way, the father of modern psychology, or of psychology, Schleiermacher says religion is a feeling of absolute dependence, or it's absolute trust. This is absolutely not what you find in so much that passes for religion, and it certainly wouldn't be found in occultism. One brings things into harmony with themselves, you know. And most of the so-called books that you can buy, they're always very expensive, and this is a very great area for making money. If you're interested in that, always are very sophisticated. They give pretty much up-to-date popular psychological explanations for what's going on. In fact, I saw a book on evil spells not long ago in which at the back it says nothing in this book is supposed to be true except in some psychological sense. You know, after going through cutting a cat up into seven pieces and sitting naked on a dead toad and, you know, all kinds of cool things. but, you know, just aids to suggestion, you know, sort of like a spiritual Tums. So I would say that in occultism you do have rationality gone rampant. After all, science, in a sense, is the outgrowth of occultism. We got into this the other night, Friday night. We can't tonight. The Renaissance was a result of the alchemical revolution, which was magic and the kind of foundational techniques that led to chemistry and on to physics and so forth in the modern world. Having a technical education, by the way, is one of the major themes that I study in religion in the age of Aquarius, knowing nuclear physics or electricity and so forth. No guarantee that you won't fall for occultism. In fact, they go along quite well together for most of us. One of the illustrations I gave in there, and like my poems, they're always based on real experiences, no made-up ones. I thought of this when my plane got hung up in some problems over Washington, D.C., landing at one of the fields there, National, I've forgotten which one now. The plane was hung up there, and I was looking around. And of course, everybody gets another drink, and when a plane has trouble, they start giving them out free, even in tourist class, you know that. And everybody tries to look braver than the next person. Every woman tries to look like she used to be a stewardess, and every man tries to look like he used to be a glider pilot. until the plane is about 15 minutes, you know, or 20 minutes into this wide looping circle, and they
finally have to tell you that one of the gear is stuck and it won't come out of the well, you know, and they're going to try to shake it down or, you know, and so forth and so on. And they're standing by with 120 fire trucks, and then all their true colors begin to show, you know. Jews begin to cross themselves, and Lutherans begin to make the sign of David and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, and it's surprising the lucky objects, the things that people rub and touch and taste. Having spent a life in all kinds of weird experiences and rather dangerous ones, I can tell you it's just interesting just to observe yourself and other people, you know, and that last cigarette and so forth and so on. When you get there, and I wrote down on the back of something or other, maybe it was the wine list, maybe it was an envelope, but later it went in the book exactly the way I wrote it. Rather than the technological, highly developed age being an age in which man cannot fall prey to magic and occultism, it is exactly and precisely the time in which this is our greatest temptation. For what is more helpless than a sophisticated, educated, urbanite traveler hanging at 15 or 20,000 feet in a streamlined jet plane, wholly and utterly at the mercy of the crew and of the ground controllers, who themselves are utterly at the mercy of their machinery, which is so complex no one of them or all of them together in one place understand its use. And so it is the case that travelers on airplanes, beneath the surface veneer of sophistication, and I travel some 15 days out of every month, so I observe a lot when I'm going along, and soldiers in battle carry good luck charms or have little lucky things they do. People who stay at home in the boondocks and soldiers quartered in barracks don't carry rabbit's foot. It's people caught up in the great, you know, things made possible by science and human invention and human organization that are put in positions where their finitude is elevated and their dependence upon invisible forces is made crystal clear.
You made a statement a little while ago that you wonder if there's something you missed, and I wonder if there isn't the possibility of there being something actually there.
Well, I said witchcraft is real. I go that far. I certainly do go that far.
In the psychological.
But you mean like the existence of the devil or something like that?
The existence of a disembodied being, which may have good, bad, or indifferent purposes.
I've certainly missed that. I would say that. And I suppose I do screen anything out. I've never seen anything that would make me, and this I haven't seen much, obviously, but I've never seen anything that would make me even consider that as a hypothesis. Although I report in this book many cases reported to me of people that supposedly communicated with the dead and this sort of business. Yeah.
Well, I had an interesting experience or two in Brazil as a missionary. I attended a spiritist center one time where they had mediums and so on. Then in my general visitation, I came to this shack, unpainted shack, to see this fellow, invite him to church. And he invited me in, we talked. And he told me he'd been converted to this particular religion, which is sort of halfway between Catholicism and Seventh-day Adventism. So he was, in his estimation anyway, a Christian at that time. But he told about how he'd been converted to that from low spiritism. And he'd been a leader of a low spiritist center in that city. All the time he was talking to me, he was shaking. I guess he shakes all the time. And he said that sometimes a captain of Satan's would enter him, make him go out at night into the graveyards and dig up bodies and things like that. And it was pretty vivid, sitting there shaking all the time, telling me about it.
Would there be any similarity in that with the evil spirits that the Bible speaks of, when people ran around?
Yes, spirit possession, of course, and what he's talking about. You know, let's be perfectly fair. The fallacy of the rationalistic period out of which we have passed, and the intellectuals and the business leaders who don't recognize this are just out of date. By the way, the advertising people know this quite well by now, and the more advanced business people do. The fallacy is nothing but, in other words, to say, you know, this is an example of a paranoia, this is an example of some sort of a schizophrenia or something, or a brain lesion or something like that. And so I don't want to fall into that. But there always are, particularly extreme cases when you're talking about the tremor and these kind of experiences, they always are subject to the dimension of the psychological explanation, I would say. But it's not just that, surely, but is it at least that? One of the things in the book is a report which was based on reading. My wife was born in Brazil, but I don't know that much about Brazil. Of the spiritual movements down there, and of a woman who had four daughters, I believe, who were prophetesses. And they were making some splash about the time that I was researching this book. It made quite an impression on the reporters from this country who talked to them. I also have a report in there of conversation with some black occultists who actually did have parts of human bodies that were desecrated from cemeteries in Cincinnati. They were brought all the way to Lexington, Kentucky for use. And there does tend to be some traffic between the black occultic groups in this kind of thing. You know, desecration of graves and so forth is on the upswing, part of the vandalism in this country. And some of it, if not all of it, is due, I think, to these kinds of things. A lot of it is due to larkishness, too, you know, I'm sure. But yes, I have talked to people who were possessed or said they had been possessed in this sort of business. They show various kinds of faces. The tremors, I've seen kinds of tremors in people. I wouldn't always associate it with that. I've seen people who didn't believe in occultism that had this sort of thing simply because they'd been up on speed, you know, on amphetamines for so long. Just something that you find. Yeah.